Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. Food. Geez, you'd think, since we all eat it, some of us cook it, and an increasing number of us still read and write about it, that we'd all know all there is to know about it. Ah, but that's if all the information that's getting to everyone is critical enough to represent an individualized viewpoint. And if the information isn't just coming from those with economic interests. So, food. What's our ancestral history, our unique needs and sensitivities, and what have the bureaucrats been promoting lately, and why? Today we concentrate on food, including how to prepare some of it. So, food and cooking for this next hour. Won't you join us? I'm joined by Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett, an environmental economist, writer, and health educator, who produces this show with me and is the primary author of our upcoming book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. I might also mention here that some of this information is coming from a variety of different sources that we've both read. Some of the more prominent people are Mark Nathan Cohen, who is an anthropologist from Harvard, and who published many years back, but still it's quite a wonderful book, textbook called Health and the Rise of Civilization. Yale, not Harvard, Yale University Press, if it's still in print. Weston A. Price, obviously, and there is a wonderful page on the Weston A. Price website, which is westonaprice.org/traditional and then low dash, diets, yeah. underscore diets. And then, of course, Clara Felix, who, for those of you who may not remember her, was a wonderful nutritional journalist for many years and wrote and read extensively on ancient diets. So one thing I wanted to start with is something that Jeffrey said when we were talking about the show, which is a comment on how it is that people have such distinctly different viewpoints on diet and how it is that people are able to make a case for whatever their proclivities are. Do you remember what you said?
Oh, well, it was from something I read on the website for the Center for Science and the Public Interest, which unfortunately had promoted a view of that we don't entirely agree with, but the concept was that everyone has a story behind their particular diet that they advocate, and the story behind the diet we advocate has to do with how the human biology has not really adapted to the modern diet, and we're seeing the consequences to it. And so that is why we, as we'll go into in some detail, we advocate something called a hunter-gatherer diet, which is essentially eating as closely as possible in terms of content of food, if not in preparation, to pre-agricultural diets that hunter-gatherers, Paleolithic peoples ate.
Yeah, and one of the other issues that comes up here is even among people who write and have done research into Paleolithic diet, there is controversy about what it means. And the reason I gave you guys the page on the Weston A. Price website, which again is westonaprice.org/traditional underscore diets or low hyphen diets, is because they talk about the controversy among the different researchers, and it's very, very interesting what they say. It's quite a long article that's there for free. What I know, and what I know from having interviewed many people over the last 15 years about ancient diets, doesn't lead me to think that people should be eating raw food, but or going out with a bow and arrow, or even trying to be that. There are people who do. There are people who have written books about this who try to be really strict to this. But what it really talks about is looking at roughly 2.5 million years of hominid and human history, looking at the fossil records and other remains, as you said, Jeffrey, so well, that human beings are an opportunistic species, which means in order to survive aggressively as we have, for better or worse, human beings have been omnivores because it meant that they could take advantage of everything that was there. Agriculture has been around roughly 15,000 to 20,000 years, and large scale maybe only 3,000 to 5,000 years. Notably, you know, what we look at when, for instance, Mark Nathan Cohen, when we look at what is examined by researchers in terms of the history, the easiest thing to extrapolate from is mummies, because you have a preserved, fairly well-preserved body left over. So in mummies, what you see now that you now have large-scale agriculture going on is we see the first incidence, well, where we can be sure of it, of belly fat, because the wrappings around the stomach give you the idea of how large their tummies were, and tooth decay, and Weston A. Price talks about this as well. But this is the first place where we see tooth decay in fossilized remains or skeletal remains. The other thing they've seen in, in skeletal remains is the difference in native cultures when they obviously look as though they had a slave class and ruling class, because part of the population is tall and shows evidence of having been eating meat, the other part smaller and appears to have been surviving on grains. So grains were a good way to keep people alive in large quantities. Now, I have a very unpopular view, which is that what grains really gave us was an opportunity to overpopulate. And that may sound harsh, because people are concerned about feeding the world and stuff like that. And that was the argument for bringing, for holding grains up as a wonderful form of food. We will talk about the food pyramid at some point, and the fact that the obvious and frightening relationship between the food pyramid diet and what's used to fatten cattle in an industrialized environment. Of course, we do not recommend eating or buying industrialized agriculturally raised food, and certainly not animals, because it's absolutely cruel and unsafe. But again, the problem with grains, just looking at them from my perspective and Jeffrey's perspective in terms of food, is that they are foods that the hunter-gatherers eschewed because they were poisonous as they stood. I mean, you couldn't just eat grasses. They had to be hybridized quite a bit for people to be able to eat. And people don't often remember this, but hybridized means that they're genetically modified. That's the only way that they could be eaten. And when they're extruded and processed to the degree that modern food is, they become very poisonous. And this is pointed out in research with rats, where they fed them, some of them rat food, some of them white sugar, and some of them various cereal grains. The cereal grain rats lived about a day. They lived longer on white sugar. They lived a week on white sugar. So very frightening food. Paleolithic people were tall. They were taller than post-industrial people, and they had larger brain cases. After the Industrial Revolution, what we see, if you look in museums around that time, late 1800s, you'll see these tiny little shoes, and you see the clothes, and the people were absolutely tiny. And the other thing is, if you go into older buildings that are more than 200 years old, the doorways are not very tall. Beginning in the 1900s, people got taller, but there was a lot of discussion early on about whether or not this westernized, as it was called, diet was good for populations, because people came to European and United States sort of places and started eating these diets that are supposed to be so bad for you. Even though they got taller, there's been feeling that they contributed to an increased risk of heart disease and cancer. Well, of course, it turns out, if you really look at some of the science that's being done on nutrition, some of this has to do with a lack of essential nutrients in the food that they're eating because of preferences toward things, or a reliance, for instance, on polyunsaturated oils, which become toxic when they're heated and fried. For instance, in Japan, they did an enormous study. this was probably about 8 years ago, maybe 6 years ago, where they looked into the relationship between increased amounts of cancer and heart disease, thinking that it was the additional meat they were eating. And then they discovered through the process of doing this intensive, long study that they actually had a lowering of strokes with the additional animal protein. But because they weren't eating as much fish, and because they were using, as I said, polyunsaturated, very fragile oils for frying, the cancer rates went way up because of the ratio between the omega-3 and omega-6 fats from these damaged oils. When you look at people's diets, the thing that the two of us feel the most strongly about is that you assess individual needs. This means you look at specific sensitivities that people have, whether or not people are reacting allergically to foods, how sensitive they are to carbohydrates. And one of the ways of assessing this easily without spending lots of money and not having all different kinds of allergic antibody systems being tried and failing in different ways is to just do a diet which eliminates agriculturally raised foods, because they are usually the big allergens. This is a very soft, gentle way of doing it. It's not a severe kind of dietary change for people. It eliminates the primary allergens, which tend to be dairy and wheat and sometimes all the grains and beans and soy and dairy for a short period of time, and then seeing how you do. We'll get into that more as we get into the show further. I have had remarkable results doing this with people in my practice because there's such a variety of reasons why people might not be able to tolerate modern foods. I've had people in my office with 40 years of heartburn do this agriculturally, lower pre-agrarian, for lack of hunter-gatherer, caveman diet, sometimes called cave person diet, and had a complete resolution of symptoms. I've had people with extreme carbohydrate sensitivities do this diet and suddenly see a resolution of weight issues, and people with autoimmune sensitivities and hyperactive allergic symptoms have some relief from eating this way. And of course, what we're talking about is eating vegetables for your carbohydrates, small amounts of fruit, maybe seeds and nuts if they're tolerated, and animal protein. This is a difficult diet for vegetarians. It isn't a completely impossible thing to sometimes figure out how to do with a vegetarian, but it is obviously more difficult because of the reliance on vegetable proteins, which we will go into more. Mark Nathan Cohen, in his book, talks about the specific problems with cereal grains as a staple in food and why it doesn't work well. So as we go, we're going to be discussing these different areas. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We're doing a show today on food, and we will also be discussing cooking food and recipes as well. So the trick is to begin to acquire a taste for whole foods and to learn to cook with whole foods, and that brings us to the recipe section of the show. This is going to be fun. One of the problems that people bring to me when they talk about cooking is that they tell me that it's impossible because they don't have time to cook. So let me tell you what I tell people when they're in my office, which is that there are many foods that are fast foods. The fastest food that conforms to our favorite sort of diet to get people back on track with their eating and to get some of their symptoms under control, being a pre-agricultural diet, all you have to do to provide a kind of a fast food deal for yourself is to take a patty of ground meat, which you can keep frozen, 5-ounce patties of meat in your freezer of, again, ethically raised, grass-fed, organic animal protein, if you can, and take a meat patty, put it into a pan with, one suggestion would be a very stable form of fat, which is an organic palm oil, which you can get in the form of an organic shortening that Spectrum actually makes, although that's only one solution, coconut oil. Tropical fats are extremely stable while heated. Olive oil, if you're really going to stir fry something, if it's a good olive oil, it's likely to get damaged heating it too hot. So I wouldn't use a vegetable oil for that. I might use butter or clarified butter if you have an allergy to milk solids. But anyway, you choose your fat, you put it in the pan, and we're not fat phobic. We've learned, both of us from experience, that eating enough fat in the diet improves satiety, reduces cravings for sugar, and people lose weight. They don't gain weight unless they're eating half a stick of butter with each meal, which is just silliness. You know, people get crazed. But and there is a sort of ramp up when people change their diet. They may eat more fat for a period of time, but it is a good idea to consider your energy use before you become dependent on only fat as a fuel source and eat nothing but fat. But anyway, so you put a meat patty in with some fat, and then you choose your favorite vegetables. One solution could be to put some green beans would cook a little slower. So if you're in a big hurry, you might want to use something that cooks fast, like broccoli or some zucchini. You can put some red peppers in there. You can have, some people like to do, you can get young eggplants that don't have a lot of seeds and just cut them up very small and add some zucchini and cook that all together. The point is that you really, depending on your taste, you can add seasonings to the pan too when the fat is hot before you put the meat in. But even just salt and pepper and the fat and sometimes a little lemon juice, any vegetables will work. Some of them cook very fast. By the time you're ready to eat your breakfast, presuming that you do a little something in the morning besides just eat and run out the door, then you will have something to eat within 5 to 10 minutes. Now, that's pretty fast. I mean, it takes that long to drive to a fast food restaurant. So that's a very fast form of eating according to our rules, and having it be very quickly. So fast is not going to be the issue here. Not eating processed foods is the issue. Another thing that we can do is just go through breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I notice that when people consider the idea of not having a scone for breakfast or cold cereal, which, as I've said, is not food, extruded grains, that what do you eat for breakfast? And people are afraid of eggs. There is no evidence that we've been able to find in any of the research, and we've dug, that eggs are a problem. The only thing to pay attention to is that if you eat any food every day, you might become sensitive to it if you tend to be sensitive to food. So you might want to alternate eggs with maybe some kind of meat patty. Now, if you are a vegetarian, as I said, this is much harder to do, but one could cook sprouted beans ahead of time. You can sprout your beans overnight sometimes or within a few days, and you can either eat them cold as a cereal, or you can cook sprouted beans very quickly in a pan and eat them warm with butter. Eating hot beans is not out of the question if you can digest them, and beans are a wonderful breakfast. For the rest of us, alternating eggs and meat is a good idea. Jeffrey has perfected the art of making a perfect omelet, and I'd like him to describe how that's done.
Well, first I put on my wizard costume with a little pointy hat that has the stars and the crescents on it. No. I found the secret to a good omelet is to get the pan nice and hot, either by cooking something fatty like bacon or heating some butter or some
organic palm oil or some coconut oil,
but getting the pan reasonably hot, meaning, you know, water will dance off of it, and then turning the heat down before you put the eggs in, and whisk the eggs up in a little bowl. I make a 3-egg omelet. You can do it with 2 eggs, cook that on a low heat for a less than a minute, and then turn the heat off and just let it cook covered until it's firmed up, and then you can put any kinds of fillings and wonderful things in it, and you'll have a nice, nice, moist, lovely omelet with lovely stuff in it.
Yeah, the real key, cheese is good if you can tolerate cheese.
If you can tolerate cheeses,
yeah,
but
if you're a dairy person.
You can put vegetables in. I haven't done this in a while, but I used to make a broccoli omelet, broccoli
can,
and cheese.
You can do some nice mushrooms ahead. You just do them first in the pan, take them out of the pan, put some more fat in the pan, and then cook your omelet. The trick with eggs is not to overcook them.
Yep.
So that's one of the problems, is that they get tough when they're overcooked. So you look for that sound, you know, when the eggs hit the pan, they should kind of do shh, you know, but only slightly. You don't want it to be so hot that it burns, and then you turn it way down. So I don't turn it off when I'm cooking an omelet, but I turn it down to the lowest possible heat. So that's really good. A solution for people who like something sweet in the morning, who kind of, when they think of not eating something sweet, it makes them sort of not happy, is to do something that I call a fruit pie omelet, which sounds really naughty, and it's developed and changed over the time that I've learned how to make it. You can put fruit inside an omelet, but you can also just start your omelet, and before, I like to turn my omelets. So what I do is, before I turn my omelet, when it's still cooking on a very low heat, I put some berries. Oh, the other thing, I'm sorry, let me back up for a moment. There's a very important thing that I do to the eggs, and that is add a very large amount, like a tablespoon, if you like cinnamon, of cinnamon and a smaller amount, you know, a couple splashes of cardamom, into the eggs. Everyone's going to be different in terms of how much cinnamon they want. I like it when the eggs are kind of brown looking. The cinnamon and the cardamom go into the eggs and whipped into the omelet, and then when you put them in the pan, they're starting to cook. As it's cooking, immediately you put either some blueberries, some blackberries, some very thin slices of peach. This is very good for summer. Whatever you like in fruit into the omelet. And if you want to do it during the winter, what you do is, ahead of cooking the omelet, you just, for just a few moments, take some thin sliced apple slices and let them boil in some water, put them aside, put the fat in the pan, put your brown eggs in the pan. Yes, I said brown eggs. And then put the fruit on top, cover it and let it cook, and then maybe flip it toward the end because you've got a thick omelet with fruit in it. This omelet really does taste like a pie, and it's really a good solution for children who are reticent to eat eggs. It really works well. It doesn't have to be big. And then, as I said, we've had the good fortune to interview some very smart people who raise food, and if you sprout your own things, if you sprout lentils or even grains, if you prefer to do that, if you sprout them, you can eat them cold, and for people who are able to eat dairy, and that's a very select group. I mean, in the initial stages of doing a hunter-gather diet to see what your problem might be with symptoms like gut problems and post-nasal drip and depression and stomach stuff and anxiety and all kinds of things, you eliminate dairy for the first 2 to 3 weeks to see if you feel better. Some people can then reintroduce dairy, and we're always talking about full-fat dairy when we're talking about doing that. But there are any number of things that you can do with it, and one of them was the suggestion of eating these freshly sprouted grains, which reduces the impact of grains having all of these anti-nutrient chemicals in them, to avoid being eaten to extinction, since these are seeds that become plants. So ancient people, as Mark Nathan Cohen mentions, eschewed these foods because they were quite poisonous, until they were hybridized. But if you sprout them, for people who are less sensitive to them, or if you sprout beans, if you are less sensitive to them, they become a plant, and you can eat them with some cream, if you like something sweet, because sometimes they become sweet, or you can, in fact, even stir fry and cook the large beans. Now, these recipes are for people who already know that they can tolerate these foods. But my experience is that people who are sensitive to beans and grains, which are agricultural foods, can eat them when they're sprouted. and they can be a nice breakfast as well. Additionally, if you're wanting to have breakfast without eggs, we've discussed the possibility of egging some vegetables and some meat. Sometimes what we also suggest is that people experiment with having some sauerkraut in the morning, and sauerkraut is very easy to make. So I'm going to turn this over to Jeffrey and have him describe how easy it is to make your own fermented sauerkraut. And incidentally, those people who cannot eat dairy are not going to be able to take probiotic pills because they have some form of milk in them. They're hidden, but it's in there, and people get sick to their stomach. The best way to get acidophilus and these other cultures is from fermenting sauerkraut, from using cabbage.
This is great stuff. The book we're about to publish, I note that at the farmer's market, one of the farmers, I was having a discussion when I discovered the virtues of homemade sauerkraut, and he said, "Oh yeah, it's its own food group," and boy, it really is. But I've discovered through various experiments that the best way to make sauerkraut, if you can do this, is to get a crock. I've got a 2-gallon crock, glazed with no lead glaze. And I get 10 pounds of cabbage and slice up that cabbage into, I use a food processor to slice it up into little threads. And
you can just take a knife and slice it across the grain very thinly too.
Yes, yes. One of the deal, I'm giving you the volume eater's guide to sauerkraut.
Well, it lasts a long time.
It lasts a very long time. That's one of its virtues. That's why it is what it is. Ten pounds of cabbage sliced into threads, and then pounded. And what I use is I've got a large metal. It's actually just large roasting pan with a pounder that is a metal pounder. I know some purists. It's a stainless steel pounder. The pan is stainless steel as well. Some people use wood, but the idea is to pound the threads once they're out. And the reason for doing that is to break the cells so that there's some liquid that it starts the fermentation process, because the lactobacillus is actually on the cabbage itself. And then I put that in the crock. I put about a cup of water per pound of cabbage with a heaping tablespoon of Brittany salt, or you can use sea salt.
Sea salt. Just don't use sodium chloride.
Yeah, avoid regular table salt. And that will not quite cover all of the cabbage, but what you do is you put a plate on top with a weight that weights down the sauerkraut, and what will happen is the liquid will come out, and after less than a day, the sauerkraut will be covered with, the cabbage will be covered with water, and you let that sit covered for about a week, depending on the heat.
5 to 7 days.
And put the crock on top of the refrigerator or someplace where it's warm and there's consistent heat. And hey presto, after a week you have sauerkraut. And to stop it from continuing to get more sour, put it in a container or put it in the fridge, and that stops the fermentation process.
People who have eaten the type of sauerkraut that you get in the store in jars on the shelf are used to them being very sour and maybe too salty, and talk about not being able to tolerate them. You can control the amount of salt that you want to use. You need just enough salt so that it will ferment. It will ferment faster in heat when the weather's warm than it will in the winter. In the winter, you might need a little more salt. If you don't want to make 10 pounds of sauerkraut because you live alone and you don't have room in your refrigerator to put all these little canning jars, you can make one quart jar. You can just stuff, pound the cabbage till it glistens a little bit. Use less than a head if you want. Stuff it into a quart jar. Add maybe 2 teaspoons of salt, maybe, or so, and some water to just barely cover it, and then take another jar, maybe a beverage jar or something, put some water into it to weight it down so that it stays under the liquid, and the same thing will happen in a smaller amount. We're going to take a brief break. This is Lena Berman with Dr. Jeff Fawcett. We're talking about food. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this.
If you go down in the woods today, you're sure of a big surprise. If you go down in the woods today, you'd better go in disguise. For every bear that ever was there will gather there for certain, because today's the day the teddy bears have their picnic. For every teddy bear who's been good is sure of a treat today. There's lots of marvelous things to eat and wonderful games to play. Beneath the trees where nobody sees, they'll hide and seek as long as they please, 'cause that's the way the teddy bears have their picnic.
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD, and we're doing a show today about food. If you missed any parts of today's show, there's a free stream available on our website all week long, a full-hour stream. There's also information about Your Own Health and Fitness, our guests, our practice, CD copies, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Our information number, 707-874-2772. Lunch. Salads are so easy to do, and they can be made ahead, and they will marinate in your refrigerator in a wonderful way. Some very fast salads, as everybody's made coleslaw. Coleslaw can be made either with, you can also make your own mayonnaise. We've discovered that making your own mayonnaise is a delight because it's alchemy, and you can watch it change. It's easier to do this in a blender or with a food processor. But you're basically taking some oil that you prefer, and the more quiet tasting oils are more fun. We're using canola, not because canola is our favorite oil, but because it is flavorless and available in organic, and you want an organic oil. The real high omega-6 oils, like the seed oils, are not quite as good for you. You end up having an imbalance with your 6-to-3 ratios, which is another show. But you just do everything at room temperature, so maybe 2 cups of oil, 2 eggs, a quarter of a teaspoon of dry mustard. God, I hope you're writing fast. Half a teaspoon of sea salt or Brittany salt or one of these other fancy salts, and then maybe a half of a teaspoon of some organic sugar. Yes, I said sugar. And what you do is you mix the dry ingredients with the eggs, and then you very slowly pour the oil in. And 2 cups of oil isn't so onerous to do this. You don't have to drizzle it. The term is drizzle, so you go as slowly as you can. If you're doing it right, it will begin to become thick, and you'll see it whip up into this thick stuff, and you put it in the fridge, and it is unbelievable. So add that to your coleslaw, if you like, or do coleslaw with, sesame oil actually is wonderful for coleslaw, with a little rice vinegar. You can use lemon juice or orange juice squeezed from a fresh fruit if you're sensitive to vinegars, as some people are. Jicama and carrot makes a good coleslaw, although jicama is not an organic food. Carrot with sliced citrus in it is quite nice. Celery root and daikon with toasted sesame oil and rice vinegar. It's better to have a food processor because it takes a long time to grate this up, but if you're brave, you can. It brews in the refrigerator and becomes even tastier with time. Jeffrey, can you describe making a Cobb salad quickly? This is again for people who can do... Oh, you can also just do a straight salad with some meat in it for lunch, you know, just some leftover chicken. Roast chicken and turkey at high heat. I know that sounds crazy, but high heat, kept enclosed. Little roasters, little portable roasters are real handy for this, but doing them at 450 turning down the heat if the turkey's getting too burnt on the outside. But having cold roast poultry for lunch is really nice. So Cobb salad.
Well, Cobb salad is one of a number of chopped salads. And so since we're limited for time, it's basically a lot of ingredients put together and then chopped finely and dressed with mayonnaise. Mayonnaise is actually a good dressing. So Cobb salad has lots of ingredients into it. But, you know, it's kind of put together the stuff you like and chop it up and put a dressing on it.
People miss potatoes and rice when they eat pre-agrarian diets. Cauliflower can be riced by grating it, and you can brown it up in a pan and turn it into fake rice. You can also mash cauliflower by cooking it till it's soft and making it into mashed potatoes. This stuff really works for kids. You can also use it instead of breadcrumbs in meatloaf using ground meats. But the cauliflower is a great substitute. The other thing you can do if you're trying to avoid breadcrumbs in food is to actually take roasted nuts, which you can roast yourself at a very low heat. You can soak them overnight in salt water and then plump them up in the oven at about 200 degrees very slowly so you don't damage the fats. And then take these nice crunchy nuts and grind them up to use for breadings for turkey cutlets or fish. The next thing that we're going to go into here is this discussion of some of the politics of food science. So how did we actually get where we are in terms of recommendations and who was involved in that? So, Jeffrey, if you would, give us some sense of how the politics of food science works and who's in charge.
About every 5 years, the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health and Human Services collect a body of scientists who evaluate the best science, nutrition science, and evaluate that and put together what's called dietary guidelines for Americans. And every year it promotes the icon of American health standards, nutrition health standards, which I think we're all familiar with, the food pyramid. What's interesting is that the science on which these recommendations are based are all very much within conventional thinking and are all very much affected, not surprisingly, by the food industry. The food industry has representatives on the committee, the advisory committee, that actually puts these guidelines together. A good deal of the science that's promoted is very much out of and based on the assumptions of what the healthy diet is, the food pyramid. And so in some respects, this, particularly to our listeners, should be no surprise that industry has a heavy influence on the outcome of this. In the last round back in 2005, there was actually a great deal made of the fact that in previous food pyramids, consumption of sugar was really focused on, and the recommendations were for small consumption of sugar in the diet. And in the latest one, and of course the leaders of the advisory committee claimed that they weren't influenced by industry, but that part of the recommendations disappeared, that consumption of sugar became a discretionary item. So, and we'll talk a little bit later about sugars and sweeteners in the diet and how problematic all of that is. But that's just a simple example of, and again, not a surprising example of how the politics works out. But there's a more insidious kind of politics that goes on. I tend to think of this, it kind of dawned on me the other day that the National Institutes of Health, which is the major government funding body for nutrition research, is a regulatory agency. It regulates knowledge. It regulates knowledge about nutrition because it sanctions and funds particular kinds of research.
I want to remind you that you're listening to a special show about food and its preparation. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. The subject is food and cooking.
I don't know of any orthomolecular researchers who have ever gotten an NIH grant. The NIH grants go to the Harvard School of Public Health and big deal universities who are all part of a system, which, again, it's a kind of agro-industrial complex for very much equivalent to the military-industrial complex. And although these are scientists who do not like to think of themselves as being anything but objective, these folks all have a perspective on what a healthy diet is. And so from that perspective, thinking of the National Institutes of Health and other funding agencies as regulatory agencies, both directly in terms of what gets funded in terms of research and what gets established in terms of policy, we can also take the next step and apply what we know about regulatory agencies, namely that they tend to get captured by the industries that they regulate. And that's what we see in the food industries. One of the more telling parts of this is we all may think that, well, those are guidelines and I don't have to follow them. I can use my own judgment about what to eat and I'd ignore the food pyramid. But the food pyramid pops up in all sorts of places. It pops up in what is acceptable journalism on food. A healthy diet, for instance, is basically the food pyramid diet, which is established by this political method. And it's reinforced with phrases such as artery-clogging saturated fats. Even though there's no that view that saturated fat causes heart disease is dead. I mean, it's out the door feet first, and only people really clinging to that notion are still using that, but still the idea that saturated fat is bad for you is reinforced, despite the fact that there's considerable research now that says that all that early research, what those researchers were seeing, as Mary Enig pointed out, is they're seeing the effects of trans fats. Well, trans fats now have become a very trendy thing not to eat, but still we see heart-clogging trans fats and saturated fats. So that's one way in which the politics of the food industrial complex works itself out. But even more directly, the food pyramid shows up in government programs such as Head Start, WIC, food stamps, and any program, federally funded program, which has to do with food, must abide by the nutritional standards of the food pyramid of the USDA and HHS guidelines. So the politics here works itself out on a number of fronts, so that in reading, getting information about what is or is not healthy, the food pyramid is certainly not the place to start. As Sally Fallon and Mary Enig testified.
Mary Enig, PhD, who's a lipid researcher.
Lipid researcher. Commented on the last round that, and as Lena alluded to, that if you look at the standards for the nutritional standards and caloric, particularly calorie standards for that come out of the food pyramid, they're quite similar to the USDA's recommendations for raising cattle, fattening cattle.
Oh, I just had a word. The other thing that occurs to me about all of this stuff that relates to what's recommended by these organizations or bureaucrats is that they are also giving money to farmers to raise certain foods. There are foods in this country that are subsidized, and those foods we have an awful lot of, and we're sort of forcing them on other countries in trade. We're forcing them to take them, and they're all in the WIC program. You know, the corn, the fructose, the processed canned goods, all the processed foods. So it's all related to food subsidies as well.
Well, as anyone familiar with those programs knows, that those programs exist not to help the poor or the indigent or those in need. They are there principally to get rid of surplus products and to provide another outlet for big-scale agriculture. One last thing I want to say about the research side of this and the science that this there's a lot to say about the science, but one thing that's important to keep in mind that, again, Lena already alluded to is that in virtually all of the research about what is and is what does and does not constitute a healthy consumption of any nutrient or any kind of food, there is never any distinction made between industrial raised food and food that is raised organically or sustainably or in actually ecologically sensible ways. There's no distinction made between I always just recoil at whenever I see in the newspaper something reported on red meat causes, you know, fill in the blank of some kind of horrible thing. And whenever I read the study, there's particularly cancer studies, that usually the actual studies, actual data, don't support the conclusion. But also there's no consideration of the fact that there are growth hormones used to mature meat, and that no one's asking the question, well, if we look at people who eat industrial-raised beef, for instance, versus those who eat grass-fed beef that are not given hormones, growth hormones, is there a difference in disease incidence? No, to my knowledge, no one's ever asked that question, or no one's ever been funded to ask that question.
Yeah, I want to stress something here. We're, of course, not harping on the idea that people should eat meat. It's really a very individualized decision. What we are discussing here is that our observation, and my particular observation in my practice, is that individuals are unique in terms of what they thrive on. And the other problem is that some people can tolerate different diets better than others. So my impulse has always been to go back to whatever science I can find, and the hard science to find is the stuff that's not tainted politically by the industry and by the government's decision about what they need to subsidize and get people to buy. The other problem is the food industry, which has now jumped on this green organic bandwagon and has an enormous supply of highly processed junk food that are organic foods. And the problem here is that eating close as you can to the natural forms of foods is always better. Eating them in a processed form always causes them to be denatured in many ways and to be problematic. We see soy as a really good example of this, because another food that's very poisonous unless it's been processed a lot, and the processing is sometimes causing it to be a food that is so highly processed that it's potentially poisoning. Please refer to the book The Whole Soy Story by Kayla Daniels for that. But the point made here is that how you decide to get your protein is going to, should, I should say, be determined by how well your gut works, what kind of food sensitivities you might or might not have, and then by the science of how food delivers nutrients. And honestly, from a health standpoint, it is still the case that sulfur-containing amino acids and the bulk of nutrients that you need to make your liver work and to get the kind of even minerals that you need, and B12 and all these essential things, often animal protein is the best way to get it. That doesn't mean that somebody who is very, very careful with how they're eating and paying close attention to how they are and using supplements can't eat in a different way. But I am also certainly recommending, both of us are, a diet that is extremely rich in plant matter, lots of vegetables and some fruits and nuts if they're tolerated. All of these foods are extremely good. We have a couple of minutes. Do you have enough time to begin to talk about sweeteners?
Oh, sure. One of the real tragedies of agricultural policy in this country is that corn has been heavily subsidized. And back in the Nixon era, when Earl Butz was the Secretary of Agriculture, a great deal was done to find ways to promote corn growers in the Midwest. And what happened beginning in that period was the creation of the industry for high fructose corn syrup. So much so that high fructose corn syrup as a sweetener has quickly displaced sugar, and that the consumption of sweeteners, what are called caloric sweeteners, which is basically sucrose, table sugar, and high fructose corn syrup, has doubled since about 1970. So what's happened here is that an agricultural policy has created a health crisis. High fructose corn syrup is in all sorts of processed products, including soft drinks and
it's in everything.
It's in wide variety of things. Fructose is not processed the same way that that sucrose is. Fructose, in fact, as promoters think this is really great because it's fruit sugar, right? And fruit is natural and it's really wonderful. And it doesn't affect, kick in insulin metabolism. Isn't that great? Except that fructose hits your liver. And, in fact, rats that have been raised on a high fructose diet end up having livers very much like alcoholics.
Right.
There's cirrhosis. There are fatty deposits. And fructose also still ends up being metabolized as fat. And it still builds up body fats. And in fact, one of the problems with high fructose sweetening is that because it doesn't kick in insulin, it simply makes you hungry without any satiety. One of the things, not that I'm recommending this, but one of the things that at least sucrose does is because it kicks in insulin signals the brain, oh, you've just had some nutrients, you don't have to eat anymore, it signals your body to stop eating. So fructose is not, high fructose corn syrup is this poison created by agricultural policy.
We should say something about the artificial sweeteners that are being foisted on consumers now, and also a word about the fact that part of what we're discussing is highly processed sweeteners also. Although we don't recommend eating sweet foods, because if you look at pre-agrarian diets, that's not what happened. People like them, but that isn't good for them, because even if they're not highly processed, they still trigger a hunger response, which triggers a kind of false starving response. So let's, if we might, just remind people that artificial sweeteners... Oh, boy.
Before we launch on there, could
sure.
I make
Please.
One mention?
Absolutely.
Continuing the fructose thought, just a piece of information here. There's a sweetener that's being sold as being natural and so on, called guava.
Agave
nectar. And agave nectar is high fructose agave syrup. It is similar in terms of how it is produced and what it is and what it does to high fructose corn syrup. So this is calling it agave nectar makes it sound natural and safe, and it is the same cautions are necessary as for high fructose corn syrup.
Yeah, the problem with agave is it's not just squeezed out of a cactus. It's processed in order for it to be used the way it is, and it's been promoted as something that doesn't stimulate insulin. The thing that people have trouble understanding when I discuss sweeteners with them is that even honey, which has a lot of health value to it, I mean, if somebody has no carbohydrate sensitivity at all, if they're really have very stable blood sugars, their weight stays very stable, they don't gain a lot of weight around their bellies and stuff, and their energy is good and this and that, and they don't get addicted to that sweet taste so that they have to have it constantly in every food they eat all the time, and everybody knows who's addicted and who isn't. Having a teaspoon of honey in your tea or something like that is not horrible. The question is, does it act like a drug on you, because sweet foods trigger a hunger response in most people, or an addictive response. But the real problem here is understanding that any concentrated form of sugar, whether it's fruit juice concentrated or these highly processed sweeteners, are going to perform in your body in a different way than eating something that's a food that has sweetness to it. And it's the thing that happens in your body is, if we're looking back at ancient diet, is not health promoting, because among other things, you're then not eating as nutrient dense a diet, and you can lose a sweet tooth. It's possible to do. I've seen it in my patient, you know, my client population. I've seen people really do a turnaround where they don't crave it anymore after a while, but it's very difficult to get rid of once you're really addicted if you keep eating a lot of dried fruit and stuff. But artificial sweeteners, very briefly, are horrible chemicals. Sucralose, Splenda, and those various ones, they're using chlorine to change the molecule so that it has supposedly a different effect. The chlorine is quite poisonous to humans. Aspartame is a combination of amino acids that never appear in nature together. They're all excitatory amino acids, and they produce very large amounts what's the name of the alcohol?
Phenylalanine?
No. Phenylalanine is one of the... They produce
methyl alcohol.
Yeah. which is present in some foods in nature, but not at the levels, and it's a brain poison at high levels. People become addicted to these sweeteners. When people have studied the effects of these sweeteners, they do not perform well in terms of keeping people from gaining weight. The body still thinks that there's a sugar response going on.
Yeah, that's exactly the problem.
They don't
lose weight.
You get a signal,
oh, sweetness will gear everything up to gain weight, and they do.
So the trick is to begin to acquire a taste for whole foods and to learn to cook with whole foods. And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. There's information about your own health and fitness, our guests, our practice, a free stream of a full hour of this week's show, and CD copies. Lots more available also at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Our information number is 707-874-2772. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.